Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Now, welcome to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, we have one of our special shows for the weekend that's in it. We're looking at the best redemption movies. That's right, movies where people get second chances. Some of them may be religious, some of them definitely may not be. I'm delighted to be joined by film buff, freelance writer Niamh O'Reilly, arts critic and movie critic Chris Wasser, who joined me in studio, who are both staring at me now. I'm usually here alone, but they're both eagerly-eyed staring at me, wondering what I'm going to say next. So what I'm going to say next is, welcome Chris, welcome Niamh.
Hey John, thanks for having us.
If those of you at home would like to get in touch, you can join the conversation. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address, and you can get me on Twitter, damn that X business, on John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. You are very welcome, listeners, and a happy Easter to you all. Guys, thank you for coming into studio. It's nice to, despite my, you know, worry about you staring at me, it is nice to have
to be here.
Two staring at me.
Yeah, exactly. Say nothing. No, it's that you're either side
it's
of me.
Weird.
It's kind of like, yeah, exactly. Sorry. So it's, people don't know the dimensions of the studio. I'm probably losing people now. We should, geography of the room, we should talk about movies. Yeah. So listen, right at the start, I'm going to play a clip of this.
I don't think you ought to be doing this to yourself, Andy. I mean, Mexico is way the hell down there, and you're in here, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, right. That's the way it is. It's down there, and I'm in here. I guess it comes down to a simple choice, really. Get busy living, or get busy dying.
Now, that was, of course, Shawshank Redemption, a movie that I have banned on this show for this slot where we do our favorite movie most weeks because it was chosen so many times. That's how popular a movie it is. And certainly the last time I checked, I think it was number one on Rotten Tomatoes. So neither of the three of us have picked Shawshank Redemption in a slot, a movie show about the best redemption movies. But I did want to mention at the start, do you guys like it?
I love it. I mean, what's not to like?
Good.
But I think, as you say, it's an obvious choice for something like this. But absolutely, it's always in my top 10, I would say.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah. Chris?
I don't think it's my favourite film of all time. No. But I also don't think it deserves the hatred towards it. Because there is...
Why do people hate it?
I think there is always...
And people love it as well.
It's because so many people like it. And it's off so many lists that it's like, oh, not Shawshank Redemption again. I'm a huge Stephen King fan. And so since I was a kid, I've just devoured everything. And I remember coming across that. I think it was Different Seasons. And I'm always just amazed how this... Like, not throwaway, but this kind of small and at first it seems like insignificant 150-page novella was turned into this 2.5-hour Best Picture nominee. I just think Frank Darabont did a fabulous job in it. He really made it his own. And he also, he did what, you know, Stephen King has always been annoyed with some directors for doing. He took a King story and completely transformed it. But King gave his approval, and I think everyone else should. It's great. There's great performances there. It's a bit of a crowd pleaser. I think the best out of Tim Robbins we've ever seen.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with it. But it's not the best thing ever made.
No, absolutely not. And I think what people have a problem with, and the reason why they love it, and Tim Robbins put it best when he said, it's because life doesn't work that way. The idea that this man would spend all this time in prison, we're not going to go through the plot of it. I think people will certainly listen
to this
show.
There's no spoilers.
What happens in it, John?
He gets out. But if that was real life, he wouldn't get out. And Tim Robbins says this great thing, you know, you're in work and you think you'll stand up and all your colleagues will follow you out the door. No, they won't. And this isn't the way life is. And it's this uber wish fulfillment. So it's just an apology to listeners who might have said, why didn't you choose the Shawshank Redemption? We're half choosing.
Yeah.
But let's go to Niamh O'Reilly's first choice, which is absolutely wonderful and very much. You don't know what movie I'm going to ask you.
No, I'm wondering, are they the order I gave them to you in?
Yeah, let's find out. No, I want to start with Leon, the great Luc Besson movie, which is sometimes called Leon the Professional.
Yeah, it is.
Tell people who haven't seen this what it's about.
I rewatched this now the other day.
For this very show?
For this very show.
Wow.
That's the work I put in
dedicated.
Here.
Wow.
Yeah, dedicated. 1994, this came out. So I haven't seen this probably, I don't know, I want to say 15 years I haven't seen this. And watching it now as a grown up and a mum, I watched it through very different eyes than when I first saw it, I must have been 13 or 14
okay.
when I first saw it, probably on a dodgy VHS copy. And totally different perspectives on it now, I have to say.
Do you have a problem with the central relationship?
It's weird because at the time, as I say, when I watched it first, I never did. There was nothing odd about that relationship to me as a...
Tell people what it's about.
So basically, it stars Natalie Portman as Matilda. She is 12, I believe, in it. And she lives in a sort of a rundown New York apartment with her father, her stepmother, and her two step-siblings, an older sister and a younger brother. Not the happiest of childhoods. Her father is out-and-out abusive. He hits her. She has bruises on her face, bloody noses. She's pretty much very unhappy. She's very disconnected. She doesn't have much, you know, love in her life, apart from her little brother, who's 4 years old and is just lovely, good-natured little guy. She spends a lot of her time kind of sitting out in the hall of the apartment, smoking cigarettes and making stuff up and occasionally chatting to her neighbour, who is Leon, played by Jean Reno. And, you know, they just pass the time of day. They don't really have a relationship or anything like that. Matilda's father gets in with some very nasty, corrupt DEA agents led by Gary Oldman, who is terrifying in this film, like really and truly he's a bad guy, and he comes along basically and guns down the family in cold blood. Matilda is out at the time when this happens, so she's coming back from being sent to the groceries, and it's a really powerful scene. She's got like these big bags of groceries, she's walking up the stairs, and she very cleverly senses what's going on, and she sort of looks to the side and she can see like blood on the floor, or her family are dead. She knows what has happened, and she just walks past the door and she heads to Leon's door and starts knocking on it and begs to be let in. And he doesn't want to. He's kind of a lone wolf. He lives by himself. He's an assassin. Yeah. That's what he does for a living. He doesn't want to have a 12-year-old girl in his life, but he does open the door. And that's kind of the start of their relationship.
And where's the redemption?
So,
because we are talking about best redemption.
Redemption. So, I mean, Leon, I mean, he's an assassin. He is not a good person. And at the start of the film, we see just how good he is at being an assassin. Mm. I mean, he just takes people out for money. But there's something as bad as that is. I mean, someone who kills for money, there is something you can see in him that there is a redeemable quality in him. And it's sort of played as if perhaps he has learning difficulties. And, you know, perhaps he's just not quite as maybe mentally sharp as perhaps, you know, your regular assassin might be. And he meets with a mob guy played by Danny Aiello called Tony, and he's the one who kind of gives him the jobs and stuff like that. And they have kind of a funny little relationship. I mean, Leon comes along and drinks milk, you know, at these sort of little talks, and Tony manages his money and stuff like that. So he almost has a childlike quality to him, Leon, you feel, even though he's a very proficient killer and cold-blooded.
But the redemption comes in the form of...
Yeah, so he takes, you know, he takes Matilda in, and for the beginning, he's like, look, you're just staying for one night and then you have to leave. But he can't let her leave, you know, and very soon he develops feelings towards her. And, you know, what she wants ultimately is revenge for the people who killed her family, mainly her little brother. She doesn't care too much about the rest of her family, to be honest. And she says to him, look, I'll clean, I'll cook for you, I'll do all of this. You teach me how to be an assassin. And he says, I can't do that, you know. Eventually he does, and they build a nice little relationship that I think when I watched it the first time as a teenager, I didn't see anything wrong with that relationship. It seemed like a father-child sort of relationship. Now that I'm a little bit older and I watched it back again, I can see there's a few question marks there. Yeah. But I do think ultimately he had paternal feelings towards her.
And at one point, if I'm not mistaken, she maybe almost raises the flag of she's feeling for him, and he... is
he
terrified
buffs it,
and buffs it off.
And
so nothing untoward happens.
Nothing untoward
happens. But I do get
that. And Jean Reno, I think, made a point of saying that he wanted to play Leon, in air quotes, as mentally slow.
Yeah.
So that people for some reason would think, oh, well, he's not going to see her in this way.
Yeah.
And he does have a childlike quality to him.
Yeah.
So he does redeem himself.
Through
his care of her, his relationship, very deep feelings. I mean...
And she kind of gets redeemed by him as well.
She does, because they get redeemed by one another. And there's a scene towards the end of the film where they have to part.
Yeah.
And she is really emotional, much more so than after her family are murdered.
Yeah.
These are real genuine tears. Yeah. She loves this man. He loves her. Like, kiss her on the forehead. I love you. You have brought me to life. He sort of says, I want a life now after this. We'll go somewhere.
Yeah.
We'll start a life. You know, we'll be happy. We'll be, you know, regular people. We won't be assassins. So it's really quite emotional, actually, that scene. And he, I feel like he redeems himself completely at the end.
And there is a plant, if I'm not mistaken, which
there
may symbolise that redemption. Yes. Chris, are you a fan of Leon?
Oh yeah, it's been quite some time since I watched it. But while you were talking about it there, Neva, I was thinking, that's a lovely little subgenre of films, isn't it? The older man and the kid who kind of comes into their life and is exactly what they need in that moment. I mean, even you could stretch that if you wanted to the second Terminator film.
Yeah, yes,
you could look at the performances and the relationship. I know it's a lot darker. It's very different between Robert De Niro and Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
The Champ, even something like The Champ. Yeah, we should definitely.
Up.
Yeah,
back.
Yes, yeah. We should do it. We should do whole special on that, John.
We will. Okay. One special at a time. Okay, so that is Leon, Neve O'Reilly's first choice for the best redemption movies. Chris wants to start with a Christmas movie. Take a listen to this.
I said I wish I'd never been born.
Oh, you mustn't say things like that. Wait a minute. That's an idea. What do you think? Yeah, that'll do it. All right. You've got your wish. You've never been born.
That was, of course, the great Jimmy Stewart there opposite the angel. The actor's name escapes me, but I think Chris Wasser might know the actor's name who plays the angel.
Yeah, actually, I'm still stuck on the whole idea of I've never been one to say It's a Wonderful Life is absolutely a Christmas film.
Oh, it isn't really. Because, I was being facetious.
Yeah, because I think it's like the last half an hour where it's December 24th and where, you know, poor George Bailey is kind of like he's just pushed to the brink and he realizes that someone is looking out for him and and he's shown what his life would have been. Why did I pick this? I think it's such a strange film to talk about. And even now, like the last time I watched it was obviously a few months ago at Christmas. And I do have a thing of watching it every year.
Yeah.
Because I like to make myself sad at Christmas. It's such a strange
Let's
one.
Move on.
It's such a strange one because that it's so enduring because it is a bit of a bleak, depressing watch.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea that like there's an angel looking at all of these pivotal moments in this man's life at his worst time. And and that the angel isn't just like going down to look after this, this human. He's going down to actually get his wings as well. So it's a very peculiar one to talk about. There's such a strange story behind it. The fact that the chap who wrote it, Philip Van Doren Stern, it took him 4 years to get it published. He ended up publishing it himself just as a pamphlet. He had no intention of it kind of, you know, making its way to a film studio, but that's exactly what happened. Cary Grant at one stage was so interested in it that he wanted to produce it. He wanted to star in it. He eventually made his own Christmas film, I think The Bishop's Wife. And that, you know, Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart, they might not have seemed like the go-to guys for this story, but they made this wonderful sentimental film that nobody went to see.
Yeah.
I find that bananas.
Yeah.
You know, there was so much press behind this. You know, it was nominated for Oscars, but it did record like something like 500,000 losses for RKO Pictures at the
1947,
time.
1947, I think it was.
In 1947, It was in 1975 then that there was some sort of clerical error with the copyright where the studio forgot to basically renew the copyright and the film entered the public domain. So channels on US networks basically started showing the film and didn't have to pay for it. And that's where you had, you know, next generation audiences discovering this film for the first time and, you know, the generation after that, like myself, thinking, why wouldn't anyone have shown up for this? It's a good redemption story because it is about, there's a couple of redemption stories in there. There's obviously George Bailey's. He kind of loses He's not a bad dude at all.
No.
But he does lose his faith, and he loses his belief in himself, and he loses his belief in people
around
him.
He loses faith because he had all these ambitions, and yet he sticks around the town he grew up in to try and save it. He's wholly good, wouldn't you say?
Apart from
getting the blues and wanting to end his life.
He ended up living his father's life, basically.
Yeah.
And he's so, I don't like the way he treats his wife in the film.
He kind of takes it, it's
almost an inconvenience for him when he first sees her, because he realizes, you're a game changer and I'm going to have to stay now. And he takes his anger out for that. And it's like, well, that's not her fault, George, but that's another matter. He's just annoyed that he didn't get to live the life that he wanted, but he was living the perfect life, as the angel shows him. So it's a good redemption story. It's a good redemption story for the angel, because the angel's in a bit of a bad place at the beginning, and then he gets his wings. It is a lovely thing. I don't think it is really a Christmas film. As I said, it's the last half an hour. People just remember, the scene where he's running through the
streets. But the scene where he's running through the streets, the reason outside of Christmas, I think the reason why it works so much is that is the redemption moment where he's running through the streets going, yay, I've survived. It's all good. And to the point that Tony Soprano, the opposite of George Bailey, is watching it one night and goes, oh, turn it off, because he can't handle this man getting the redemption. So I think that's one of the most cinematic redemption moments ever coming to screen. Yeah. You know?
And I think they had to put that in there too, because I think Frank Capra was, he admitted it more maybe than Philip Van Doren Stern did, that, that story was directly influenced by, Charles Dickens' Scrooge, Christmas Carol. And that is the Scrooge moment. That is the moment where the protagonist runs around the place going, what day is it? I'm alive, and celebrate. They had to put that in. It's just the tip of the hat. It says, like every other Christmas story after Christmas Carol, this is directly influenced. I think it's a fabulous film.
It is. It is a fabulous film. And surprisingly long. You think it's this kind
of
Christmas thing, but it's actually quite long. Niamh, we're coming up to our first ad break, but in a line, are you a fan of It's a Wonderful Life?
I'm going to make a terrible admission here.
Oh, no.
I've only seen it in bits.
Okay.
I haven't sat down to watch the whole thing. So I don't know if I can give a proper...
Well, when you leave here...
homework is...
Exactly. You're listening to a special Screen Time where we're looking at the best redemption movies. I'm talking to Chris Wasser and Niamh O'Reilly. We're running up to our first ad break, but I'm going to quickly give you mine. I need to talk the least. But my first cinematic experience of redemption, Return of the Jedi, right? I was 9 or 10 when I went to see it. And it's the moment where Luke Skywalker, this... Greek tragedy of sorts, Shakespearean tragedy, where his ultimate enemy turns out to be his father and they're going to kill each other. And then he stops killing Darth Vader because he's his father, and the Emperor tries to kill Luke, and Darth Vader turns from the dark side to the good side. It sounds like a kid's story, and it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And throws the Emperor into that thing. And to this day, as soon as we started talking about this, the first thing I thought about was redemption movies. And what the Return of the Jedi, or the first thing I thought of was Return of the Jedi, and that scene in particular. Mm. Forget the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi. They're problematic. They tried to turn it into the Muppets, but it is a great ending to that three-story
arc. It's quite complete.
I think. I really think Return of the Jedi, and that moment where Darth Vader throws the Emperor in and then Darth Vader dies. So it's actually not that small. Now, he does come back later as a ghost when the Ewoks are having a barbecue. But let's park that as well.
Star Wars Chris, barbecue.
You're kind of grimacing at me, are you? Or no?
No, I have a lot of problems with Return of the Jedi, and there was an awful lot of pressure there. You were never going to better the Empire Strikes
Back. No, I know.
But I think the reason why I loved this when I was a kid, this seems so... It's such a weird thing to love about the film, but the black jumper and the green lightsaber.
Yes.
That
I was
cool.
Like, Luke looks so cool.
He's the coolest he's ever looked.
Definitely. Yeah. And probably the best acting.
Yeah. He was very serious, throughout that.
He kind of got better, Mr. Hamill, on that one. We better take our first ad break. Plenty more redemption and second chance movies to come after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. We're doing one of our special shows where we're looking at some of the best redemption movies of all time. Yes, it's vaguely Easter themed, I suppose, because the foundation story of Easter is a man dying and coming back to life. What greater redemption is that? And second chances. Before the break, we were talking about Leon. We were talking about It's a Wonderful Life. We did mention The Shawshank Redemption, and I mentioned Return of the Jedi. Niamh, your next choice of movie, pretty dark, fantastic movie with a troubled production, if memory serves, American History X.
Yeah, it is quite a dark one. So this is 1998. Edward Norton was in this, And yeah, it's a pretty dark one. So he is a neo-Nazi, basically a white supremacist. And he gets sent down for brutally murdering.
Yeah. Very brutal.
Really brutal. This African-American kid who was in his driveway. And that scene, I think, will stick with anybody who's ever seen it. He gets sent off, quite rightly, to prison. And has a redemption of sorts in prison. Has an awful time in there. He sort of gets himself in with the other white supremacists in prison for protection. But Derek is someone who has very sort of high ideals around his beliefs. And when he finds out that the other white supremacists in prison aren't quite as high and mighty as him, he sort of turns his back on them and they carry out a terrible retribution against him. He's sexually assaulted in the showers. So he's totally out on his own. And he finds a friend in an African-American inmate who he has to work with in the laundry. And throughout his stay in prison, and he realises that this guy was actually looking out for him.
Yeah.
And he's the only one who saved him from being completely destroyed by the other gangs in prison. So it definitely, what he goes through in there changes him completely.
Yeah, and it's funny, I have vivid memories of that redemption scene where he's leaving prison and he says to the guy,
yeah, I think feeling you had something to do with
it. Like, I knew nothing about it. Yeah,
and I think the film is told in sort of a flashback as well, and the flashbacks are in black and white. And you can see that actually he isn't really like this. I mean, he started out as quite a good guy, a good kid, a quite idealistic kid. And you know, talks very fondly about a teacher he had in school called Dr. Sweeney, played by Avery Brooks, who's brilliant in this, actually. And there's a scene where they're sitting around the table and Derek's father is sort of putting his beliefs on Derek, kind of very racist beliefs. Mm. So you can see that the seeds were planted very early for Derek, and he never really had a chance, you know.
Yeah.
And his father is murdered on the job, and that kind of sets Derek off
and
the path.
That redemption then transposes itself onto the care for his younger brother, played by Edward Furlong, who's about to get mixed up in all that as well.
So Derek gets sent off to prison and Danny is sort of left to fend for himself and is going down the exact same path that Derek did. He's almost groomed by these white supremacists. The leader is called Cameron, played by Stacey Keach. And they take him in and brainwash him effectively, and he is going down the exact same road. So when Derek gets out of prison, he wants to save his brother, wants to save his family, he wants to get them away from these people.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He's seen how wrong these beliefs are, and it's incredibly difficult to do.
Well, hold that thought, because we have a clip of that. And this is not for younger ears, because I don't want to bleep this, because I think it's important we hear all the bad things he has to say.
I'm lucky. I feel lucky because it's wrong, Dan. It's wrong, and it was eating me up. It was going to kill me. And I kept asking myself all the time, how did I buy into this shit, you know? And it's just because I was pissed off. Nothing I ever did ever took that feeling away. I mean, I killed two guys, Danny. I killed them. And it didn't make me feel any different. Got me more lost, and I'm tired of feeling pissed off, Danny. I'm just tired of it.
Edward Norton there talking to his younger brother, Edward Furlong, and that is Niamh O'Reilly's choice for our best redemption movies, American History X there. And it, in 30 seconds, Niamh, sorry, that's my way of telling you, tell me quickly, but it had a pretty troubled getting to the screen, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it did.
Didn't Edward Norton take it over in the end?
Well, he put himself into the script and made a lot of changes to it.
Okay.
And there was a bit of friction with the screenwriter. But I think in looking back now, they're okay with it.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was difficult for sure.
Chris, are you a fan of American History X?
I'm a fan of his performance in American History X. And also Ed Norton, like, taking over. What a shock. I think the film is very good at showing us that nobody is born full of hate. And nobody is born a racist. And it is very good at showing us how these vulnerable younger characters can end up brainwashed by these people that they're looking up to. And I think Ed Norton is terrific in it. And also a very brave performance for himself and Edward Furlong and everyone involved to be in this film that was almost impossible to market. Mm. You know, it's not as if I mean, even the posters for it, as you recall, like with the swastika.
Yeah,
the
he's a swastika tattoos. On his shoulder.
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one to say we're going to go see that on Saturday night.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a brave film. His performance is very good in it, but the film around him is a little bit wobbly.
Okay. We don't have time to get into that, but I'm not sure. I'm just so taken with his performance. I think it completely
it's
gets
very timely now for today.
Yeah.
Go back and watch it.
Little has
the way
changed,
the world has gotten worse.
Yeah.
I think it's
really,
really timely.
Well, listen, something very different is this. Get no argument from me, Chris Wasser, for your second choice for your favourite redemption movie, Rocky.
Yeah. You know what annoys me, John? You know when you see those lists of...
Yeah, we only have 30 minutes left, so, you know.
You know when you see those lists of worst Best Picture winners? And Rocky always comes up, you know, it comes up next to, let's say, Forrest Gump, the year that Forrest Gump in 94 beat like something like Pulp Fiction. Well, in 1977, Rocky beat Network and All the President's Men. Mm. And there's this thought that, you know, Rocky didn't deserve it. I think it did.
Absolutely.
And I'm willing to die on this hill that Rocky is one of the best films of the 1970s.
Can I put it to you, it became a prisoner of its own subsequent franchise hell.
Yes.
But if you watch the original movie, it is a bona fide classic. It's a dark tale. I'm stealing your thunder.
No, that's it. Yeah, you've said it better.
Okay, let's move on.
Stallone at one point was interviewed and he said that Rocky was very much a film, a story of its time. And the problem with the sequels was that, you know, Rocky 2, 3, 4 and 5, they were trying to keep up with the times. Mm, and that's the difference. And it got to the stage where it was almost like he was making, you know, a parody.
Yeah.
But that original tale, it's not really a boxing film.
No,
it's
I know.
It's a full-on redemption story. It's about an ordinary guy who's just... He missed his chance. He's not living the life that he's supposed to. He's not living up to his full potential. And he's given this outrageous opportunity, which, you know, in terms of, you know, the boxing world, it's not that far-fetched.
Yeah.
That, you know, a world champion as, you know, cartoonish and as charismatic as Apollo Creed is in this play by the late, great Carl Weathers would stand there on television and say, I'm going to give an opportunity to a small fight. That has happened.
Yeah.
And so this story of this bruiser, this, you know, loan shark, debt collector, you know, this guy who's just, he's not living up to his full potential, that he will be given that second chance. That is so relatable. I also love that just Stallone was at a point in his life and his career where he said, I'm not getting the parts that I want to get, so I'm going to go write it myself.
Yeah.
And I love this idea of him, you know, shopping around the screenplay and just, I think he had Henry Winkler helping him out at one stage, but just saying, nobody gets this unless I star
it.
Yeah. And I don't think you see an awful lot of that anymore. I don't think a complete unknown, which is as he was, he had bit parts.
Yeah.
I don't think a complete unknown would get that opportunity these days.
Yeah.
It's just so wonderfully acted. There's such little boxing in it. The story, you know, about Paulie and Adrian, the story about the relationship between Rocky and Mickey is so lovely realized, so brilliantly acted. The score, fantastic. It really was the beginning of something special. And I know, we made fun of it at the start. It has had, you know, there's been dodgy terrain. Like it's been difficult watching.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Sequels,
but the first one is an amazing film. Yeah. And I love this. It was actually in an ad for Sky where Anthony Hopkins was probably paid a hatful of cash, but he talked about it being his favorite movie. Mm. And he talks about the scene on the steps and he says, yeah, it is hokey, but who cares? Life is hokey.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of with him. And the other thing that I think is great about it, when you actually get to the fight, and it doesn't matter, it's however many years old now, right? 40, but nearly 50, God help us, right? But it's a spoiler, but he doesn't win the fight. It's a draw. So it's not that unreal. Well, I guess boxing draws are unrealistic, but it's not like he's given the bouquet of flowers at the end. It doesn't have that ending where it's all neatly tied up or anything.
No, that fight was loosely inspired. It was based on a Muhammad Ali fight.
Yeah.
But, I think it was Wepner was his opponent. And nobody thought, you know, Wepner was going into it. I think it was Frank Wepner was going into it as the underdog. And he went 15 rounds with Ali. And so that was based on reality. And I love that when they get to the final round and Apollo Creed just says to Rocky, there's not going to be a rematch. And he's like, I don't want one. And then, you know, you've got some studio guys going, well, we'll see about that.
You might change your mind.
Stallone is sensational in it. He gets such a difficult time. You put him next to, you know, misunderstood actors like, I don't know, like Keanu Reeves. Like people always saying that, like, these guys can't act. No, they can. They were doing something special in that. I put his performance in there with what the kind of thing that Brando was trying out at the beginning of his career.
I completely agree with you. And there's other great Stallone movies like Copland and even a movie no one's seen called Paradise Alley. He's a good actor.
Yeah, he is.
He did some stuff that maybe took away from that. Are you a fan of Rocky, Niamh?
100%. Yeah. Oh, how could you not be?
Good. I love Correct
good
answer.
Rocky training montage. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to a special Screen Time. We're looking at some of the best redemption movies of all time, second chance stories. We should mention in passing, I mean, it's not a religious show, but we are looking at redemption because of the weekend that's in it. And if you are of that persuasion, the foundation story of Easter is about Christ being crucified and then coming back resurrected. In terms of the most recent showing of that, or certainly the one that pops into my mind, The Passion by Mel Gibson. What do you guys think of that movie?
Tough.
It's not a pleasant watch. I wouldn't be sitting down with my popcorn to watch.
It is a good redemption story told very, very well, I have to say, I think.
Yeah, there are parts of it that are extraordinarily well made. It is a bit of a slog. I remember going to see it for the first time. Our religion teacher took us to school and we all came out of it not the best. There wasn't much of a conversation afterwards. I just don't think there was an awful lot of conversation afterwards, in the media about the violence in it. But even still, when you watch it, you just can't believe that they've gone that far with it.
Yeah. But you see, Mel Gibson, who has all sorts of problems, right? And talking of redemption stories and stuff. But the idea that he was attempting to convey, if you believe in the story of Jesus Christ, getting punished and crucified is horrific. And he was attempting to show that. And mission accomplished, you would have to say. Now, there were certainly, I remember talking to a Jewish friend of mine, and when you relook at the casting of the Jewish characters, it's hard not to think it's not incredibly anti-Semitic. But I do think there are very interesting cinematic things in that movie.
Yeah, Mel is a good director. I mean, Apocalypto is one of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. It goes into my top list all the time. So there's no denying he has skills behind the camera. I just think, was there really a need to go, as far as exposing Jim Caviezel's ribs at one point?
Yeah.
I mean, it just was brutal in the extreme.
Well, Mel would answer he suffered for you and I, but that's Jesus as opposed to Mel.
Both Mel.
Mel did suffer.
He'd probably argue that he suffered for you and I as well. Yeah.
Let's not get into the Mel Gibson rabbit hole, or we'll never get out of it. So listen, my second choice, if I can nominate another one, is... This is definitely hokey, and I am in no means claiming this is the greatest film ever made. Far from it. But for a redemption story, Good Will Hunting is hard to beat, right? So in case you don't know, Matt Damon is this genius who goes around fixing quadratic equations or physics problems or something like that. Something that involves a lot of brain power. And he does it in MIT, and he's had a very tough childhood in foster care. They realize he's a genius. Stellan Skarsgård, who was on this show 3 weeks ago, decides in order to get him out of court and not go to jail, he's going to bring him and tutor him and work on really incredible maths with him. And as a way to keep him out of jail, he's been court ordered that Matt Damon will also go and get therapy. They try him with lots of therapists. None of them work. However, he rubs up against Robin Williams in a career-defining performance to me. I just think it's one of the best things he ever did. And slowly they have this kind of guy-cry relationship and they become friends. And he eventually gets redemption because Robin Williams, as hokey as it sounds, in a scene that could bring me to tears if I'm not careful, tells him repeatedly it's not his fault. Mm. And I remember as long as I live that scene and how in a cinema I was in 1998, people openly crying and going, oh my God. And I've read stuff about it subsequently. Psychoanalysts and psychologists have said, look, therapy does not work that way. You don't get healed in one session. And I completely get that. But for a cinematic slice of redemption, it's one of my favourite scenes ever where Robin Williams says to him, it's not your fault, and his life does improve. Discuss!
I like Good Will Hunting.
It may be a guy's movie.
No,
my wife has said that to me.
I don't think so.
No?
I do enjoy it, and I think, as you said, Robin Williams for me is just, I'm so glad that he won the Oscar for it and everything, and he was brilliant in it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's the first one that comes to mind when redemption movies are mentioned, but now that you have, laid it
nearly
out
there, come to tears.
Yeah,
she doesn't want to say anything against it now.
No, I do like it, and I would sit down and watch it. I you know, I it wouldn't probably be in my top list of films, but I do like it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good.
Correct enough answer. Chris, Goodwill Hunting, you're gonna break my heart here, right?
Oh no, I kind of love it. I do, yeah. Imagine being in your early 20s as Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were at that point and just coming out with that.
Yeah, I know.
Straight away.
I know. It's incredible.
No, it's sensational. It's so strange that a couple of kids from Boston gave Robin Williams the best script of his career.
I know.
And it's such a shame that we didn't see more of Robin Williams like that.
Doing those.
I feel like every other time he went to do dramatic work, it was maybe a bit too dark or a bit too strange.
Yeah. But they Dead Poets Society, though.
Yeah.
Actually, forgot about that. How can I forget about that? That's a very strange one.
You know the way I mentioned earlier the favorite movie slot in this show? I'm always reminded of Dead Poets Society. Sheila Shoaga was so in love with that movie that back in the day, and she's a similar vintage to us, she recorded the sound, not the soundtrack, but the actual audio of that movie from a VHS. So used to walk around with the Dead Poets Society just like in her ears without a screen back in the Walkman days, listening to the movie. Isn't that incredible?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of inspiring. You run around with the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Seize the day.
Captain in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Captain, my captain. Well, listen, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to a raucous Screen Time. Well, maybe raucous is the wrong word, but an entertaining Screen Time, hopefully.
I think so, yeah. We make ourselves laugh anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're looking at the best redemption movies of all time. If you want to get in touch, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email screentime@newstalk.com. We have one more ad break to take and some more redemption movies after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. We are looking at the best redemption movies this week, best second chance movies, a special little show for this Easter weekend. Why? Why not, right? I'm in studio with freelance writer and film buff Niamh O'Reilly and arts critic and film journalist Chris Wasser. Chris, we're going to go to your choice now. I said this was a fantastic list. I'm going to be honest, this one doesn't do it for me. I have only seen it once, so I could be wrong, but take a listen to this.
Jerry!
Yeah, what can I do for you, Rod? You just tell me, what can I do for you?
It's a very personal, very important thing. Hell, it's a family motto. Are you ready, Jerry?
I'm ready.
I just want to make sure you're ready, brother. Here it is. Show me the money.
Cuba Gooding Jr. there asking Tom Cruise to show him the money. We are talking about Jerry Maguire in A Month of Sundays. I never thought you'd choose this, Chris. Tell our listeners why.
Everyone's at their best in this film. Cuba Gooding Jr. was certainly at his best. What a disappointment.
So, Niamh, what's he tonight? You were thinking about...
I think he is pretty great in this. I think Tom Cruise is at his best here. Renee Zellweger. Cameron Crowe, what a slip it's been for Cameron Crowe. Mm. I mean, he had this, and I think he had Almost Famous either before and after. And if I'm right, I don't think he's directed a narrative feature in like 9 or 10 years.
Yeah, it's funny. I can't remember. Yeah,
I really wish he would find his mojo.
Just remind people what it's about. Tom Cruise is a sports agent.
He is a sports agent. And after staying up late one night and doing something he shouldn't, which is writing a memo about, which goes against all of his agency's policies, he loses his job and he leaves and he has this very public meltdown and exit from the agency. And one of the people there, Renee Zellweger, she decides to leave with him because he says he's going to create his own agency and it's going to, you know, they're just going to be friendlier to work with. He's just going to, he's going to change his life altogether. The only thing is, he doesn't have any clients, but he has one American footballer who he takes his chances on, Cuba Gooding Jr., while he's actually following someone else, because Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character has never really been given a good chance on the field. And so it's all about how, you know, this employee at the agency, Renee Zellweger, she takes a chance on Tom Cruise's character, Jerry Maguire, but she's also in love with him. It's also about how Jerry Maguire, you know, his fear of being alone. Mm. You know, he does initiate a relationship with Renee Zellweger's character, but at the beginning it's just out of that. It's that he just doesn't want to be alone and he's afraid of commitment at the same time. And then it's all about like how Cuba Gooding Jr. might, his footballer character, he might, you know, get his chance. So there's an awful lot going on in there. The reason I love it so much is it's a great sports film. Brilliantly assembled sports film. It's a wonderful romantic comedy. It takes all the boxes in terms of romantic comedy. There is a lot of chemistry between Renee Zellweger
and a great use of the Bruce Springsteen song Secret Garden.
Fabulous use of that. Yeah, that is very, yeah, see, it does sound like you like it there.
You complete me, Chris.
Yeah.
You had him at hello.
Help me. In terms of quotes, I mean, Cameron Crowe was just, he was being greedy with this one. Every great romantic comedy needs a memorable quote. There's about four or five of them in this.
Yeah.
And as I said, it just gets the best out of everyone. Tom Tom Cruise over the last maybe 10 to 15 years, American Made aside, and I know we're going to discuss some more films now in a minute, American Made aside, he's been doing largely action and sci-fis. But you go back to this in the mid 90s and you see this guy was so good with drama. Yeah. And he was so, when he's acting, when he's really on, there's nobody else in the room. There's no other movie star like him. And it's a wonderful redemption story because he starts off as such a self-absorbed, just arrogant, obnoxious prat. And by the end of it, you are rooting for him. And you're rooting for the relationship with Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character. You're rooting for the relationship with Renee Zellweger. You're rooting for him just as even a potential dad to Renee Zellweger's kid. It's a wonderful transformation and I love it and I won't have a bad word said about it.
Niamh, are you a fan of Jerry Maguire?
Do you know, it's a film I haven't seen in such a long time and you have really, I think I might go,
yeah,
I'm not going to go and watch it tonight, but over the next few days, yeah. I think I would
watch it. I'm tempted to rewatch it based on your recommendation. You I've seen it once only and I just remember everyone talking about it and my memory of going to see it was just Cuba Gooding Jr. shouting all the time and Tom Cruise shouting back. And then he shouted at the Oscars incessantly as well when he won the award.
Yeah, yeah.
But look, I think you may have convinced this room.
Yeah. Okay.
We'd love to know out there in Radio Land what you think of Jerry Maguire. Why don't you email us, screentime@newstalk.com. It's odd when I look down the list because I've one more to do. Tom Cruise features in this list three times, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's
indeed
kind of weird,
he does. It is kind of weird. So, Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes, I love this movie. It's a real guilty pleasure. I rewatched it again for coming on here. And it's a time loop movie. And I am a sucker for a time loop movie. And on paper, this shouldn't work because it's Groundhog Day meets Saving Private Ryan meets Starship Troopers. Mm. And you just think, what sort of combo is that? But it works so well. So you've got Tom Cruise. He's playing Major Cage. He's like a PR guy. For the army, and the Earth has kind of been, I suppose, invaded by these extraterrestrials called mimics. Very hard to beat. We're losing. So he's out there kind of selling the war. He's on all the TV shows and stuff like that. And he gets basically demoted and sent to the front as a private. And he is a complete coward. He does not want to be anywhere near the battlefield. I don't think he's ever picked up a weapon. So for him to be sent to the front and told, hey, you're going in the first wave, it's just like the worst thing ever. He tries to run away. He's basically forced onto the front. He's dropped in and he gets killed probably in 5 seconds, or 5 minutes flat. He doesn't survive. And then the screen goes black and he wakes up again and he's back in training again. And we suddenly start to realise we're stuck in a time loop here with Tom Cruise. And along the way, he meets Emily Blunt, who is this really hard Lieutenant Rita Vertasky. And she's the only one who has helped to have a victory so far against these mimics. So he meets up with her and he suddenly realises that she also was stuck in a time loop but lost the power a while ago. So she helps him and trains him and they have to kind of go after the Omega, which is like the big baddie who's in charge of all the other aliens. So if they destroy the Omega, they win the war. And it's what I like about it is that it's quite funny, like it's quite darkly comic because Tom Cruise dies a lot in this film in a lot of different ways. And you are actually like you're laughing along at some of these and some of them are horrible deaths. But it's just written in this great way, you know, where he's like he's this unlikable guy and he's kind of learning along the way. And you can't help but sort of, you know, laugh when he dies some of the times. And Emily Blunt is a great counter to him because she's very strong and she's very hard and she doesn't take any crap basically. So they're a good combo. And of course along the way he develops feelings for her because he's reliving the day over and over and gets to know her intimately through this time, whereas she only gets to know him once, you know, this is the first time she meets him. So I like it. It's got a really good balance. And towards the end he is redeemed because when he starts off he's this awful coward, you know, and there's nothing redeemable really about him. But then at the end of the film, he does start to put other people before himself.
Yeah.
He puts Emily Blunt before him. He puts the world before him and does end up saving the day.
I have never seen it. Chris, I know it's terrible. Chris, do you agree with Niamh's?
I do. And I also think you don't have anything to feel guilty over. It's a terrific film. I think those time loop films are so difficult to do. But I thought Doug Liman with Christopher McQuarrie and Tom Cruise, they made it look easy. It is darkly funny. It's very clever. Yeah. Great stuff out of Brendan Gleeson. And yeah. I think it's one of Bill Paxton's final performances
he's
as
so
well.
He's so good in this. Yeah. Oh, I love Bill Paxton. And he's hilarious in this. He's a drill sergeant. Okay. And he's really, like, he's grilling, you know, Tom Cruise. And he has this kind of southern accent as well. And it's hilarious.
Okay. Yeah, no apology, Chris is saying.
Okay,
so,
cool.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, listen, talking of Tom Cruise.
I see. It's my understanding that the information supplied by you and your company and the answers to the questions that I've asked is incorrect, Frank. And if I want to get to the bottom of who you are and why you are, then I think that your family history, your actual family history, well, this is important.
What is your f***ing question?
Well, I guess my question's this. Why would you lie, Frank?
That is Tom Cruise there getting rather angry with a question from a prodding journalist. Is there any other kind of journalist, really? So we are looking at the best redemption movies of all time. We're nearly out. That is my last choice. I'm talking about Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson. Really, Paul Thomas Anderson, who's a brilliant filmmaker, his rationale for this was he thought there was no epics made about human drama. There was epics about war and, you know, the usual topics of epic movies. They're mostly about war and stuff and conquering people. But he wanted to make one about human dramas. And he started listening to the songs of Amy Mann, brilliant singer-songwriter, and conceived of this script where there are all these lost souls. Some of them are fronting up, like Tom Cruise there, who seems to play a modern or a pre-Andrew Tate kind of character who goes around telling groups of men how they should pick up women and really very nasty, but he's a pretty sad past. There is a kid who's on a TV show destined to be the quizmaster of America who's having a terrible time. John C. Reilly plays a beautifully sweet cop trying to do the right thing. Jason Roberts plays a pretty nasty TV executive. There are all these people losing their way and trying to find redemption, but not making a very good job at it. And the Tom Cruise character in particular has an issue with his father. And he, along with the other characters I mentioned, find a vague kind of redemption. And that's what I love about this. And the movie is too sprawling to go into any long plot description. But frogs fall from the sky, which is rather absurd. And also at one point, the characters all sing Amy Mann's song Wise Up, which also seems kind of absurd. Yet, post those events, there is this very human redemption where people, almost once the rain has passed, eke out of, I might be able to get through this. And there is no, yay, everything's great, like It's a Wonderful Life. It's kind of like, life is shit, but I might be able to accommodate the shit. Yeah. And that's all that movie is saying. I absolutely love this movie as a redemption movie. Have either of you seen it? Have both of you seen it? And what do you think?
Yeah, Niamh? I haven't seen it in a long time, but I do remember Tom Cruise's performance in this. And I think it's the first time watching Tom Cruise as an absolute dirtbag.
Yeah.
I just, even the hair slicked back.
And yeah.
It was like he really sold this toxic masculine performance. So he's great in it.
Yeah.
He really is.
And when he goes to his, and it's a spoiler, but you know, that's what we're doing. We're talking about redemption. When he goes to his dying father's bedside, man, it's one of his great performances. And he's in tears. And, you know, it's called acting. I don't know. He didn't look like he was acting.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of that movie, Chris?
Oh, I am. Yeah. It's a lovely, great, big mess of a film. I had to.
Life is messy, though. Yeah. Ape, Anthony Hopkins in an ad for Sky.
A family member asked me recently to what Magnolia was about. I think it was on there, and they asked for a synopsis. I needed to lie down afterwards. So thank you very much for that clean summary. That was very good. Wow. Again, you have a director getting the best work out of actors, the kind of work that we don't usually see. And I do think Tom Cruise, it's turned into the Tom Cruise show, but he's very good at playing a deeply unlikable character.
Yeah.
I'd love to see more of that.
He's brilliant in it. He really is. I think it's his best performance, and I wish he would do more of that kind of stuff. So what is it about Tom Cruise in redemption movies, I wonder?
don't know.
Maybe he's trying to tell us something.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Okay, again, let's park that one. Guys, we have about 3 minutes left. So are there any honourable mentions either of you would like to do? Something you don't feel we got to when we're talking about great redemption movies. Niamh?
I think Atonement is one. I really like it, but again, it's very heavy. I think sometimes it's nice to have redemption movies that aren't quite so emotionally battering. But I do think it's a lovely film and the performances in it are great.
Yeah.
And it's beautifully shot as well. You know, you really feel every, you know, moment in it and the warm, you know, summer that they're having and the costumes. And I just love it. I love the chemistry between James McAvoy and Keira Knightley. And of course, Saoirse Ronan. Was that her first big screen performance in that?
Yeah, she's great.
As Bryony, she's great.
I'm about to turn to Chris, but what just popped into my head there, because I was thinking of the war scene or one of the battle scenes in Atonement, Empire of the Sun by Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
Because that was on the TV a while ago. And just where his parents find him again at the end. Oh my God, the redemption in that movie. Yeah. Chris, any other quick honourable mentions? I know you want to mention Groundhog Day. I love that movie. It's just we've mentioned it many times.
I think it was it on the list of best comedies for?
Yeah, it's on every list.
It's the ultimate redemption film. You've no Groundhog Day, you've no Edge of Tomorrow.
That's true.
But again, those kind of films, those kind of stories are very difficult to pull off. But Bill Murray sold it to me. Bill Murray can sometimes show up a little too uninterested in the material. I think that was one of the few times where he actually thought, we're on to something special here. Yeah. And his transformation, it is believable.
His redemption is believable. And funny, Niamh was reviewing Ghostbusters last week and you felt that he really didn't show up. And it's a fine line with him.
It is, but you can tell when you think, as you said, when he's phoning something in and he just, in that he really,
I once spoke, and we'll finish where we ended up or where we started. I once spoke to a Jesuit priest who gave me this very Christian take on Groundhog Day in a way that it's kind of a biblical story about repeating ourselves until we make a change. Anyway, I just said I'd throw that in there.
Yeah.
You have been listening to A Special Screen Time. We there are so many more movies we could have made reference to. We've been talking about the best redemption movies and the best second chances movies. You can listen back to this show if you're listening on the radio. Screentime.com is the website. Newstalk.com is really the website. The mother website, the Alpha and Omega website, the Go Loud app is where you'll find it all. I've been talking to freelance writer and movie buff Niamh O'Reilly. I've been talking to Chris Wattiser, arts critic and film journalist. I'm going to play out not with Bruce Springsteen, not with Amy Mann, but from a pretty tame reworking of Bob Marley's Life, but the gorgeous redemption song.
All pirates, yes they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships.